come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're sitting here in a nook of my attic room, a window between us looking out onto my backyard. It's a drizzly spring day, but the grass is green and growing, and the two large silver maples are covered with burgeoning leaves. If you come to visit me in a few more weeks, my backyard will be bright and verdant and alive, finally basking in the miracle of spring. But if you hadn't watched it grow, if you hadn't seen that miracle happen, it wouldn't particularly stand out to you. It doesn't look that different from the backyards we expect from Americana, the kind you might see recreated on a set for a sitcom or in a picture book. A grass lawn, a few trees, a swing set. We have this picture of a typical American home, one that includes maple trees and squirrels and twittering birds, one with seasons, snow days, falling leaves, April showers. I know, because it's a myth I grew up with. I spent my childhood in a very different part of the United States, in the Sonoran Desert of Tucson, Arizona, a place with very distinct flora and fauna, unfortunately lumped with the American exemption of out west, a place you might picture as flat, beige, empty except for some scrub brush and maybe a lone cactus. I grew up in the shadow of mountains, playing in a jungle of a front yard filled with mesquite and Palo Verde trees, creosote bushes, beds of aloe, an array of cactuses, barrel, choya, prickly pear, and yes, saguaros. That's what that lone cactus is called in your mind's image of out west. It's the tall, ridged cactus with one or two curved arms. You've probably seen it on a logo, or a t-shirt, or a silly cartoon, perhaps wearing sunglasses. It's ripe for anthropomorphism. There's even a Muppet. And you might be surprised to know that it only grows in the Sonoran Desert, in southern Arizona, and a strip of western Mexico down to the Gulf of California. That's because Arizona was a common place to film westerns. There was even a film studio built in 1940 called Old Tucson, a backlot of sorts, a folly of a western town. It served as a filming location for the original 310 to Yuma, Rio Bravo, and McClintock. But only one of those films takes place in Arizona, and possibly not even in the Sonoran Desert. Still, it's the picture in your head. A misplaced plant which, unless you know, you assume grows throughout Texas and New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. And because of the saguaro's connection to out west, it shows up in illustrated and animated form when you want to communicate desert. But these depictions are usually so off. There's little understanding of how large mature saguaros are, 15 to 20 feet tall, or that they don't grow arms until they're between 75 to 100 years of age. A couple of years ago, my husband played the game Horizon Zero Dawn, and it hurt my soul to see 4 to 5 foot tall saguaros with 7 arms in the ruins of southern Utah. If you have lived in a place, if you know that place, you understand when it is portrayed falsely and when it is portrayed authentically. And that's why I'd like to talk today about a film set in an entirely different place and culture, 2010's Winter's Bone, directed by Deborah Granick. It tells the story of 17-year-old Ree Dolly, who lives in the Ozarks of Missouri with her 2 younger siblings and her mother, who is nearly catatonic for an unexplained reason, likely a combination of mental illness and trauma. Ree, a high school dropout, is the sole caretaker for her family. One day, the local sheriff shows up on her front doorstep looking for her estranged father. He was arrested for cooking meth and put up his house and property as bail. If he does not show up to court, in 1 week, Ree and her vulnerable family will be evicted from their home. Ree must travel through the backwoods of rural Missouri into the depths of a criminal network in order to find her father and protect her way of life. You probably haven't seen this movie, and that's okay. It was nominated for 2 Oscars, including Best Picture, but it probably wouldn't have been nominated if the pool hadn't been expanded beyond 5. It's one of those jewels of independent cinema. It debuted at the Sundance Film Festival and won the Grand Jury Prize for Dramatic Film, going on to have a small debut in 4 theaters in New York and Los Angeles, later playing in a smattering of Heartland cities, where it did fairly well for its size. Even so, it became the lowest-grossing Best Picture nominee since 1983, and one that few people, if any, talk about. It's mostly remembered for its star. This film was the breakthrough role for Jennifer Lawrence. She received her first nomination for Best Actress as the quiet but tenacious Ree, trudging her way to answers, pushing further and further into danger, knowing to give up means losing everything. It's certainly the part that won her the role of Katniss in The Hunger Games. Of the 2 characters, Lawrence once said something to the effect of, "Katniss runs, but Ree walks," which is a fairly good comparison of their characters. I remember reading the coverage of the 2011 Oscars. Ree is a country girl in the winter, dressing largely in sweatshirts, thick coats, and work boots. She wears little to no makeup, and her blonde hair is often tucked under a beanie or pulled back. So reporters were surprised when her actress showed up on the red carpet in a slinky, bright red dress, and it was Jennifer Lawrence. It was almost funny to watch them discover that she cleaned up so well. I watched this movie for the first time in college, on a laptop in a study carrel while making flashcards. I was still fairly new to independent cinema. You see, when I was in middle school, my family moved from the Sonoran Desert across the country to a tiny town on the outskirts of Appalachia, though deep enough that we learned the local pronunciation, Appalachia. It was far too small to have a movie theater. 2 larger towns nearby did, cycling through blockbusters. Mid-budget films would make their appearance, but only for the requisite 2 weeks. We'd never been an opening weekend kind of family, preferring to wait for movies to come to the cheap theaters. But we had to learn very quickly. If you don't see a movie in the opening 2 weeks, you might not be able to see it in theaters at all. Very occasionally, we'd drive to the nearest city to watch a smaller film, but that required a day trip, and so it didn't happen much. So my exploration of independent cinema was largely through the internet. I'm indebted to Yahoo Movies and Rotten Tomatoes for showing their reviews of indies, and I became well-versed at reading about movies I knew I may never see. I also explored libraries, and while our local collections were very small, the library at my small liberal arts university had an excellent collection of old and new cinema, and made sure to acquire Best Picture nominees when possible. Which is how I ended up watching Winter's Bone on a laptop. I knew a little about the story from what I'd read and the clips I'd seen of Lawrence's performance at the Oscars. I knew it was a crime film, and possibly even that it was what the author of the source material called a country noir, but I was not expecting the experience of watching this film. The opening shot of this movie is of a field obscured by bare trees. In this field is a collection of abandoned vehicles, cars, trucks, an RV, and a school bus. I was taken aback. I paused the movie to check where it was shot on IMDb. It was indeed filmed in Missouri. But it looked like the land where my family lived. And that site, a field of abandoned vehicles, was so specific and exactly the sort of thing movies set in the boonies do not portray that I felt unnerved, especially the school bus. It isn't a junkyard. It's just a field. The next shot shows Ree's siblings playing outside, jumping on a trampoline without a net. Next to them are pieces of plastic kiddie furniture, a bench, and a plastic kitchen. Not the kind of toy you find outside houses, but inside. And then you see them sitting on a couch on the front porch, not a patio chair, an upholstered couch. If you had asked me to articulate the specifics of an authentic portrayal of the communities near my parents' home, I could not have identified these things. But I recognized them immediately. I have never in my life seen plastic kiddie kitchens outside or a full-on couch on somebody's front porch, except in Appalachia. Then Ree takes her siblings to school, and I again had to stop the film, flashcards abandoned. The hallways of this school look exactly the same as my high school. One corridor in particular, near the gym in this film location, is exactly the same in architecture as a hallway I walked every day of my high school career. And the gym itself is a dead ringer for my middle school gym. On the loudspeaker is an announcement for a meeting of the Future Career and Community Leaders of America, the FCCLA, an organization I have only ever heard of in the context of my high school and this film. One whose members were, for lack of a better turn of phrase, the people who stayed. They had no intention of going to college or leaving for a higher paying job. They planned to stay, living maybe a mile or two from where they grew up. Shortly after, in the film, Ree goes to visit her friend Gail. Gail is probably 17 or 18. Gail is also married, with a baby. I knew quite a few people who married after high school graduation, and at least one classmate married at 17. It was legal if your parents agreed to it. My junior year of high school, at least 1% of the student body was pregnant. This was normal. This was ordinary. This is not what I expected to see as the backdrop to this story, its assumed setting. It was unnerving in a way that's difficult to describe. Exposing. Uncomfortable. Incredibly specific. And unexpected for two distinct reasons. First, the Ozarks are not a part of Appalachia. Not all rural America is the same or has the same culture. The university where I sat and watched this film is in a tiny town only slightly larger than where I attended high school, but it is in the Midwest. That is not a location signifier only. During the westward expansion of white settlers in the U.S., European immigrants tended to settle on land that reminded them of home. There's a reason Minnesota is connected with a specific accent. It was largely settled by Scandinavians. Who else would flock to those kinds of winters? It felt like home. Large portions of the Midwest were settled by German immigrants, who found the prairies and forests similar to German plains. They built a very practical culture with hearty food. A fixture of potlucks in my college town was homemade egg noodles, and every local restaurant featured fried pork tenderloin. which is literally just schnitzel. The Appalachian Mountains are an old mountain range, tracing its roots far, far back to what is known as the Central Pangean Mountains, a range that existed before continental drift occurred. The remnants of these mountains also include both Ireland and Britain. So when the Scotch-Irish, a group of people composed of Scottish Presbyterians who relocated to Northern Ireland and, far later, fled economic hardship, came to the American colonies in the 18th century, they found mountains that look like home. Mountains that, unbeknownst to them, were the same as home. What I didn't know when watching Winter's Bone, and what I do know now, is that later, as westward expansion pushed native peoples out of their land and white settlers moved in behind, the Ozarks were first settled by descendants of these Scotch-Irish people, seeding Appalachian culture again in the mountains. So the culture in this film shares deep connections with the town my family lived in, far more than where I went to college. Appalachian culture is old and complex. It places a great value on family networks, a holdover from its Scottish roots, where clans are reborn into kin. One of my friends from high school often refers to her hometown as having nobility, old, deeply rooted families whose names show up again and again. In Winter's Bone, this kind of family network is Ree's one connection to navigating the criminal underworld safely. "You and me is kin," she says. "Ain't that supposed to mean something?" Appalachia is full of a community that takes care of its own. I remember a kid in high school getting into a bad car accident. Someone placed a cardboard can next to the lunch line in the cafeteria, asking for donations to help with medical bills. It was assumed that we, his classmates, would help take care of him. In Winter's Bone, Ree and her brother watch their neighbors skin a deer, in a time where they're struggling to feed themselves. He wonders if they should ask for some food. Ree takes his chin in her hand and says, "Never ask for what ought to be offered. Community support is a cultural assumption." Appalachia is a place with a deep musical tradition, folk songs and folk instruments. In sixth grade music class, we learned to play the dulcimer, getting quizzed on Down in the Valley. Our district had retained a good music program, and every time a performance of our string ensemble was lagging, we pulled out some bluegrass fiddling and slap bass, and all the smiles appeared in the audience. In Winter's Bone, music accompanies the few joyful scenes of this story. A gathering for a grandma's birthday. The finale of a strumming banjo. It also opens the film, an a cappella version of the Missouri Waltz setting our scene. But these things, these signifiers, are all the more unexpected when you consider my second reason for surprise at the experience of watching this film. That mountain people are very often poorly represented in the media as cartoons and caricatures, idiot clowns, or ignorant villains. This was especially true in the early 2000s. While there were conversations throughout the 90s into the millennium about cultural sensitivity towards other races and people groups, hillbillies remained ripe for entertainment value. So many reality TV shows thrived off this image of poor, fat, dumb country people. Movies, too. While every TV procedural got to have a special episode in Appalachia where bigoted, inbred racists killed some poor, sweet girl, these images were everywhere. I think it's easy to forget how vulnerable mountain people are. These are the poorest areas in the country. They have tied themselves to a place they love, these mountains that are home. And employment is complicated. The land is how they survive. And for a while, they did so by exploiting that land through coal mining and logging. But those are dangerous professions, one that put bodies in harm's way. Some get by farming, although the land isn't valuable for large commercial farms. And others have found alternate ways of living outside the law. Moonshining was historically an option, and during Prohibition, it kept quite a few families fed. So it should be no surprise that producing illegal substances is still a thriving industry. Not to mention, life is hard. And many people with hard lives find unhealthy ways to escape. I want to be clear. Appalachians aren't criminals. I don't think Wintersbone thinks they are either, even if it is a crime drama transposing the noir genre to a rural setting. It isn't the crime that felt familiar to me, but the haunted look in these characters' eyes. I have seen people like every character in this movie while filling up my car at a gas station or shopping for groceries at Walmart. And it felt bizarre to watch a movie that understood how vulnerable this community is. Even the characters that are violent criminals elicit compassion in their continual collapse into terrible cycles. And what struck me then on my first watch, and what continues to strike me now, is that this movie was made by outsiders. Deborah Granick is from Massachusetts. She went to Brandeis University and got her master's from Tisch. On that DVD was a commentary with her and the cinematographer Michael McDonough. He's a Brit. This is not their community. This is not their place. But they weren't content with a stereotype, with a saguaro in Utah. They researched the Ozarks. They visited homes, observed how people dressed and talked and decorated their front porches. They cast locally, and it mattered to them that Jennifer Lawrence was from Kentucky, even if it was the western half. When I try to explain Appalachia to other people, there isn't much media I feel I can hand over as an accurate representation. There are a lot of 4-foot-tall saguaros, stories about poor people wearing a full face of makeup in their too clean cars and their nice new jackets, talking loudly about a popular political issue for New York and Los Angeles so those audiences will feel sympathy for them. There aren't many stories that feel right, that show people I recognized, that are honest about what's good about the culture of hill people, and truthful about the vulnerabilities and the spirals that continue to bring suffering. But if you want to know what the setting of Appalachia feels like, what it looks like, what it sounds like, Wintersbone, a crime noir jewel of independent cinema, is a surprisingly good place to start. And maybe, if other filmmakers are as attentive as Deborah Granick, our picture of America will begin to look a lot less like my backyard and more like the beautiful, complicated place it actually is. Thanks for coming.